session number 21729, Rule 3.
Mr. Frank Cottam, Rule 3.
So we took Millingen, we moved on then into a town called Anolt, which we captured, and shortly after that came the breakout. We crossed the river Issel and were swung in out across the plains of northern Germany in the general direction of Hamburg and Bremen, all of which went reasonably well. I can't remember we had any real tough experiences until we got to Bremen. There was quite a battle for Bremen, which I missed because I was on 48 hours leave in Brussels at the time. It was my turn, and so I missed the Battle of Bremen and joined the company again just afterwards. And we were heading up towards Bremerhaven on what in those days we used to call the Cuxhaven Peninsula, when we got the information that the Germans had packed in. And I think that day was the 5th or 6th of May. It was actually before VE Day itself. And so there was great celebration. We were all dead pleased. It was over and we'd survived it. And then about an hour later, the company commander came along and told us it wasn't over. There was a mob of Germans somewhere in front of us who wouldn't surrender, and we'd got to go and clean them up. So that took the shine off things until we got the later information. There were Germans in front of us. They hadn't surrendered, but that was because they had no one to surrender to. He got it wrong again. And all we had to do was go and take the surrender and round them up and head them off towards a POW camp. And that was the end of the war, as far as we were concerned, except that we were all then concerned, I suppose, that we might get recalled to England and sent out to Japan, or to Burma, because that battle was still on. Through from the Air Force, and in particular the rocket firing Typhoons, and it used to be quite a morale booster to see the Typhoons going in, and you'd see the stream when they fired heading down towards the ground, and we knew that one of those rockets that the Typhoons fired would knock the turret off a German tank with no problem, and so we were always pleased to see them buzzing around above us when there was any trouble.
Could they really be that accurate, could they?
They were, yeah, they were extremely accurate. Anyway, we didn't get sent to Burma, of course that was over a few months later, and in November of 1945 the battalion was sent to Italy, where we were part of the occupation force in Italy. We had a few months down at Bari, on the heel of Italy, on what they called garrison duties, which was mainly doing guard duties. Then we went up to Trieste, and this was in the summer of 1946. In Trieste, mm-hmm. War was over. At that time, Tito was still laying claim to the town of Trieste and the area, the province around it, Venezia Giulia, and the Western Allies were saying, no, you can't have it, just because your partisans occupied it in the last days of the war doesn't mean it's yours. And so we had a post on the road that ran out of Trieste down the Istrian Peninsula to Pola at the bottom of the peninsula. We had a post about 6 or 7 miles outside of Trieste at a place called Lazaretto. And 100 yards up the road, of this coast road, the partisans had their post. And they imitated everything we did. If we had a drill parade, they had a drill parade. If the orderly officer came along and turned the guard out, they turned the guard out. One day we dug some slip trenches, and they sent a civilian over who measured them and went back, and they dug slip trenches, presumably to the same measurement. Our CO at the time was a chap called Longsdale, who used to say, "Keep it up, lads, and we'll make soldiers out of this bloody rabble yet," just by letting them imitate us. So we stayed there for some months, and then we went to Mestre, which is on the mainland end of the causeway that runs out to Venice. And in early 1947, the battalion went into what euphemistically called suspended animation, which means they were disbanded. And that was the end of the 4th Dorsets for a time. We were split up and moved all over the place. I went for a time to a job down on Rimini Airfield, which was a big POW camp, and I was posted to, I think it was 374 POW Guard Company. The POWs there were not Germans, they were Yugoslavs, Ukrainians, and various other assorted Eastern Europeans who had been captured fighting alongside of the Germans. Some of them were those among those who were sent back, and Stalin and Tito dealt with them very summarily, and most of them were killed. Then after a few months there, I was posted back to Germany, and was on the staff of a reinforcement holding unit at Bielefeld and then at Hanover in Germany for about 2 or 3 years. Nothing very exciting, it was just normal German occupation duties. We spent most of our time playing football and cricket and hockey and generally, you know, having a quite a good time. And then in 1950, summer of 19... Sorry?
What was your rank at that stage?
I was a sergeant by then, yeah. Then in 1950... summer of 1950, I was posted. Oh, I'd signed on by then. I'd deferred my demob several times, which you could do in those days on a voluntary basis. I did out actually in 1947, and I signed on what was called gentlemen's agreements, which meant you stayed in for 3 months, 6 months, or whatever longer. I did that several times. Then in 49, I think it was, I signed on a regular engagement, 5 years with the colours and 7 with the reserve. And shortly after that, I was called back to the UK, to Bulford on Salisbury Plain, and from there I was on a post into the Wiltshires at Hong Kong. Supposed to be a 3-year tour. We were diverted from Hong Kong onto Japan as reinforcements for Korea. And after spending Christmas in a reinforcement holding unit in Japan, I was posted over to Korea and joined the 1st Gloucesters.
How did it feel for you joining the Gloucesters, and what did you know about them?
Well, I didn't know a vast amount of them. It's always a bit, not difficult, but sort of also always a bit odd when you join a new regiment, as it were. Having worn Dorset on my shoulder for the previous 6 years, and I was just as upset when I joined the Dorsets because I had to take my Sherwood Forester down, which was my local regiment. But I knew I knew the Gloucesters were a pretty good regiment. They're a regiment that you probably know that wears two cap badges, one at the back and one at the front. And it has been said jokingly that that's because they don't know if they're coming or going. But and sometimes I wondered. But it's not really that. It's because in 1801 at Alexandria, they were surrounded by the French. And the order was given rear rank about turn, and they fought back to back, which is the origin of the back badge. And they seem to have made a habit of it ever since. If you read their regimental history, they did something similar against the Sikhs in the Sikh Wars. They did it, I believe, just before Waterloo against the French again. And some of them did it on the way back to Dunkirk in 1940. So they've made quite a habit of fighting back to back. But you move to a new unit, you settle in, you get to know people, and you know, you develop an affinity, especially if you're in battle with the unit, because I don't know, it's one of those things. You're proud of that unit afterwards.
Can you remember the date when you arrived?
No, I can't. I know I spent Christmas in Japan, so it was probably late January, early February, I would guess, but I'm not at all sure, no.
And what year was it?
That would be January, February of 1951.
Whereabouts did you go to when you arrived in Korea? What?
Well, I landed, we were flown over from Japan to an airfield right slap bang in the middle of South Korea called Suwon. It's a town of Suwon with an airfield nearby. And from there, we were taken, I suppose, by vehicles, lorries, to the Gloucesters. I think, but I'm not absolutely sure, it was a place called Pyeongtaek or something like that. But I wouldn't, I wouldn't risk being a millionaire on that question, on the answer to that question. And I was posted to A Company of the Gloucesters as platoon sergeant. They had a battle, not very long before that, at what's known as Hill 327, and they'd taken a few casualties there, which is probably why I was posted to the Gloucesters. Although I did wonder, having been originally a Sherwood Forester, then posted to the Dorsets, then on a draft to the Wiltshires, another West Country regiment, and then to the Gloucesters, West Country again, I came to the conclusion that somebody in the War Office must have decided I would only serve with Swede bashing regiments, although if I had gone to the Gloucesters, I would probably have gone to the Northumberland Fusiliers or the Ulster Rifles, with whom I had even less in common than I did with the Gloucesters at that time.
What would you say was the average age of the Gloucesters at that time?
I don't really know, because there were all sorts of... In my platoon, for instance, there were a few people like myself who were regular soldiers in their early 20s. I suppose I would have been about 25, 26 then. There were one or two reservists who'd been called back, and they were most unhappy about that, as you can imagine, having done their service in World War II and settled into Simi Street for a few years, and then get called back and sent out to Korea. There were one or two what were known as K-type volunteers. They were people who volunteered for the Korean War. And there were also a few national servicemen who were about 19 year old. So it was a whole range of people from about 19 to about 29, I suppose.
Wouldn't the regulars and the reservists have been very important because of the... The experience.
I suppose they were, and I imagine that may be why they were called back and pitched into these platoons. Or either that or they just needed people. But It was a real mixed bag. Yes, the reservists, having had war experience, were useful in that respect. On the other hand, some of the reservists were so disillusioned with having been called back that they were not necessarily a good example to anyone. They didn't want to be there. It's as simple as that. We've done our bit. We won World War II. You know, what are we doing here?
Had they seen battle before?
Oh, most of them, yeah.
Out in Korea, I mean.
Oh, before I joined them, you mean? Well, they'd had this battle at Hill 327. I'm not sure they'd had much other than perhaps a few skirmishes, but nothing on a major scale, I don't think.
At the time of your arrival there, how much did you know about what was happening in Korea?
Well, I remember that when the Korean War broke out, I was still in Germany. And I know there was quite a lot of talk about it's a good thing that the UN have decided to stand up for South Korea, that the communists are going to be stopped, as it were. I don't know if you know, but at that time, the Russians were rather sulking and not attending United Nations meetings because no one other than Russia and the East European Communist bloc would recognise the Chinese Communist government who'd just taken over in 1949. And so they, and Chiang Kai-shek, the old Chinese leader, still occupied the Chinese seat on the Security Council and in the General Assembly. And the Russians were boycotting meetings before that, and which was a mistake, really, from their point of view. Otherwise, they would have vetoed any resolution about aid in South Korea. So I knew that sort of background, you know. And then on the way out there, we used to get lots of news bulletins, and we were following what was going on fairly closely, even when we thought we were going to Hong Kong, because there was always a chance that you were going to get involved sooner or later anyway. And certainly once we were told we were being diverted onto Japan, we were very interested in what was going on. And I remember it all seemed as though it was going to be over round about November, after McCarthy had landed after MacArthur had landed the troops at Incheon and driven the communists out of the North Korean communists out of South Korea and right up into North Korea. And then, of course, round about November, we got news about the Chinese troops, and we realised it was a different war game that was going on. So, yeah, I knew quite a bit about what the score was, yeah. And by the time I got to Japan, of course, the thing had changed completely out there. The Chinese had recaptured the whole of North Korea, recaptured Seoul, the South Korean capital, and were halfway down the peninsula towards Busan again. And although I wasn't there during that big retreat, some of the lads in the Gloucesters who were not very impressed with the Americans' performance at that time. They said they seemed to only have one idea, which was to get down to Busan and get back to Japan and get the hell out of it. Bug out was their favourite manoeuvre.
Of course, the history books are full of this.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, you were there, so what experience did you have of it?
Well, the American Marines were okay. The rest of them were, up to the time I was captured anyway, we didn't rate them very highly at all. I think part of the problem was that the Americans had this draft system. And it was possible to get out of the draft if you had a good reason. And a good reason was if you were attending university or college or got a responsible job or whatever. So the only guys who couldn't get out of the draft were the heroes of wood and drawers of water, as it were. Not the brightest in the Americas. And so it was perhaps understandable in some ways that they didn't perform awfully well as soldiers. They'd been drafted in against their will. They were not the cream of America, and they didn't perform like the cream of America either.
Although we were not by any means a military family, like most families, all the males, most of the males, got involved in the services during the war. My eldest brother was called up in early 1940, spent quite a long time in England in the Royal Army Service Corps, but then found himself in a beach group landing on D-Day. And in fact, he's got a commendation from signed by Montgomery on account of whatever it was he did there. I had another brother-in-law who was in the artillery and who landed on D-Day. I had a brother-in-law who was badly wounded at Dunkirk and invalided out the army shortly afterwards. And another one, brother-in-law, who went in late 1940 and spent most of his time in Italy and North Africa during the war. I came to it late, not joining until I was 18 year old, I think I mentioned this earlier, on the 2nd of March 1944.
What about your sisters?
My oldest sister was in civilian work, real civilian work, hosiery factory, all through the war. The next two eldest sisters both went into bomb making at Stanton Ironworks near Nottingham, although they had been in hosiery until the war. I cannot remember what one of the other sisters did. And the final one also went into a hosiery factory, but she was very young anyway to have been employed in war work or anything else.
During the time that you were overseas, did you communicate with your family?
Oh yeah, I used to write home. At least I thought I wrote home fairly frequently, although I occasionally had to use what we called field cards, because you weren't in a position to write. A field card was a little cardboard thing that says things like, I am well, I am wounded, I am drunk, I am sober, I am broke, I am flush, and you crossed out the appropriate bits and signed it and sent it so that people knew you, at least you were still in the land of the living. I wasn't a great communicator, letter writer, I suppose, although I did, knowing the circumstances and how people back home worried, I did try to write, you know, as and when I could to my parents. I wasn't married at that time. I had been known to arrive on leave and to be told by my mother, what are you doing here? I said, well, I wrote and told you. And then I discovered the letter is still in my kit bag. But I imagine, you know, lots of people of my age did silly things like that in those days.
Did you receive any parcels?
I must have done. I can't remember anything in particular. But I must have had things sent to me from home, if only, you know, woolly comforters and balaclavas and things like that. Cigarettes, probably. Going back to Trieste, and the fun and games we had with the Yugoslav partisans, we were on a checkpoint on the road that led out of Trieste down the Istrian Peninsula to Pola at the bottom of the peninsula. The Yugoslavs had a post about 100 yards up the road, and they used to make a nuisance of themselves. They used to come creeping through the wood by the side of the road and cut our telephone wires at night and leave rather unpleasant calling cards for you to put your foot in and things like that. At that time, we were getting the usual army 50 free issue cigarettes a day, which was in a little round tin, just held 50 cigarettes. And we were getting a type of cigarette which I've never known before and have never known since. They were called Superfine Magnum, and they weren't very great. To stop the Yugoslavs' little game, we used to thread these empty cigarette tins on strings and wires and lay them in this copse, in this wood, so that if they came walking through at night or creeping through at night, they would catch the wire, the tins would rattle, we would make a noise and perhaps rattle our rifle bolts and shout, and they would clear off again. And that was I suppose, one of the first barriers that the West introduced against the communist hordes. Empty cigarette tins, superfine magnum cigarette tins, stretched on a piece of wire. And we used to call it the superfine magnum line.